Welcome to Halal Money Matters, sponsored by Sojourn Capital. I'm Monim Salam. And today we have a very special episode. You know, there's been a lot of turmoil in the market in regards to the Trump tariffs. They're on, they're off, they're changed, they're this way, they're that way. And so we recently, myself and our director of research, Dan Kim, did a webinar discussing these tariffs, the impacts on the market, and how that affects our portfolios and the way we think about what we buy and sell. What, if anything, should you be doing with your portfolio, right? Is it the right time to allocate now? Should you be allocating? Should you not? And is it important for us to be able to, you know, take some of the cash that we have on the sidelines, put it in, or should we wait? So I wanted to share this webinar with you, and that's going to be the nature of this podcast today. Let's get started.
All right. Thank you all for joining this webinar this evening. We appreciate you being on. Let me start with the top nine reasons why people should not time the market. Now, obviously, this is a man-made issue this particular time. Sometimes it's other issues, like when the pandemic occurred. That's a natural issue that occurred. So, you know, there's things that we can look at from the past, but missing the best days of the market is going to have a huge erroneous kind of thing happen to your portfolio. And that's not well said, but that's, you get what I'm saying there. I'll give you an example. From 1928 to 2020, if you were invested in all of the days of the market, that's almost, you know, 90 something years, and you started with just $1,000 in the S&P 500, you would have ended the year 2020 with $211,000 plus. If you would have missed just the five best days and the five worst days, you would end up with $198,000. So a little bit shy of the person that just stayed in. If you would have missed the 10 best days and the 10 worst days, you would have ended up with $171,000. And then if you would have just missed the five best days, you would have been at $113,000. And if you would have missed the 10 best days, you would be at $74,000. So obviously, you don't want to miss the best days. Nobody can predict the future. That's number two. Even professional fund managers like what we have on today are not able to, you know, time the market, figure out what the bottom is, et cetera. And then number three is behavioral biases. Emotional investing will lead to bad timing. Fear during downturns, greed during rallies, we see it all. These psychological traps will result in buying high and selling low. Number four would be timing requires two perfect decisions. You have to time it right when you're selling, and then you have to time it right when you're buying. There's long-term trends, and they beat the short-term moves. So over time, markets trend upward, despite the volatility and chaos that you might see during some parts of the trading month, day, or year. So investors who stay invested will tend to capture the long-term growth, just like I mentioned at the start. Number six is compounding will work best with time. So, you know, compounding is one of those things that will allow your portfolio to grow at an unbelievable rate over time. It's not going to work in a year or 2 years or 3 years. It takes time. And so interrupting that process slows your wealth building. Number seven, market bottoms are invisible. And you'll see this not only in the stock market, but also the real estate market. By the time you realize that the market has hit the bottom, it's already usually rebounded. And then at that point, it rebounds sharply and you don't know when to get in. And you're thinking it's going to drop again, and you end up never getting in. Number eight is tax implications. Frequent in and out trading will trigger short-term capital gains, and you don't want to have the tax consequences on top of selling at the wrong time and buying at the wrong time. And then number nine is just stressful and distracting. So, you know, constantly watching the market and trying to make moves will cause unnecessary stress, and it distracts from your broader financial goals. So those are my top nine list of why you should not market time. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we are recording this call. We'll put it on our website at some point. We would like for you to start asking questions, and I'll moderate that and have our two guests here today who work at Sojourn Capital and who manage our funds. I'll have them speak in just a minute. But you know, volatility will feel like turbulence on an airplane or any kind of, you know, uncomfortable situation that you're feeling. And that's why we have a large number of people that have joined us on this call today, because we don't know what to make of this, right? As individual investors, we don't know what to make of this. So we need people to tell us about historical trends, what might be happening, what might happen in the future. And then additionally, we have people that have been investing for a long time, and you'll see them putting more money to work at this time. But then you'll see people that are just getting into the workforce, just starting to put money in, and they might be a little bit stressed out during this time. So you're going to have people in all kinds of different places emotionally. Recent historical similarities are what we try to find in the market. And one that we found recently, obviously, it was just a few years ago, was in 2018 and 2019, but it was more limited. It was a minor trade war with China primarily, but also with some goods from Mexico and Canada and from Europe as well. So, you know, our speakers can talk a little bit about that as well, and you can ask questions about that too. So what does it mean for mutual fund investors who have professionally managed accounts, right? Compared to somebody that's thinking about buying and selling on their own. You're in a good place if you have a professional money manager. And this is one of the reasons why you invest with us, is for people like Monim and Dan Kim. So I'll start off with just introducing Dan very quickly here. He works at Saturna Capital, which, as you know, is the advisor and manager to the Amana Mutual Funds. The Amana Mutual Fund started way back in 1986. So, you know, many years of investing research and portfolio management. So he's going to speak second, where we're going to start with Monim Salam, who is a director of Saturna Capital, executive vice president and portfolio manager of the Amana Income Fund, which was our first fund, started in 1986. And he's also the manager of the Developing World Fund, which started in 2009. We do have four funds, as most of you know. I'll turn it over to Monim. He has a presentation, and Dan will take it from there afterwards. All yours, Monim.
So I wanted to, first of all, thank everybody for joining. I know this is a very volatile time in the market. A lot of, maybe for some of you, gut-wrenching, those type of things. So we wanted to kind of have a webinar kind of really explaining exactly what's going on, right? I mean, it's really difficult to do, especially we're trying to explain something in the middle of it happening. When anything can change, tomorrow might be different than yesterday, maybe different than next week. But so this is going to be a very general one from that perspective, because we really don't know exactly what the greater longer term ramifications are going to be specifically for the market. But there are some guideposts that we can use, and those are the ones that we're going to try to get into. What this seminar is not going to do is going to be able to predict the future. So even in your question and answer, if you're going to ask the question, I'll just give you the answer right now. We don't know. However, you know, as Awais mentioned, there are ways for us to be able to maybe look at the past and maybe draw some similarities as to what could happen, what could not happen, and then go from there. So we'll start there and get into the presentation. I wanted to, again, just kind of give a start off with just a brief background. And in that one, let's talk a little bit about what tariffs really are. Right. As you know, we have a global economy, and goods are being made in one country and, and sometimes actually even multiple countries, parts of certain items are made in multiple countries on the world. They're shipped to a certain location, they're assembled and then shipped to their eventual location where they're sold and those type of things. What tariffs basically do are they tax on the goods that are being sold that are not made in a certain country. Right. So really good example of that. I was living in Malaysia, back in the teens of the 2000s, and they had an import duty on cars, and that import duty was 300%. And so you can imagine, like, if you bought a local car that was assembled locally or bought, made locally, it would cost, I don't know, let's say, give an example, 50,000 ringgit. But if you bought a similar car, like a sedan or something like that, but for Toyota or GM or something like that, those would cost automatically 150,000. And so that tax is what is actually a lot of countries do when they're wanting to either restrict a certain product from coming in, when they want to have a homegrown product made in their own country. And that's kind of very similar to what the US or the Trump administration has been trying to do. So what is it that they did? They basically came out, and after a couple of earlier on, when there's been volatility throughout the year because of this what the Trump administration has done is really forecast that they are going to be raising tariffs, right? So they did it on China, then they did it on Mexico and Canada, then they delayed it for a month, and then they implemented it again. So all of these things are happening, but then Trump asked for an Independence Day. That was last Wednesday, and what he announced was basically across the board on any country, there's going to be a 10% tariff, okay? And then it's going to be higher for countries like China or EU, others that have some type of he came up with a formula. It doesn't make any sense, so there's really no point in getting into how they came up with it. But the formula has to do with the GDP of the country and also the trade deficit that they have with the United States. So what that equals to, China being at 54%, the EU is going to be at 20, and there are some countries that are much higher than that, and some countries that are at the 10% level. But the baseline for all of these things was going to be 10%. Okay, so that's really what it is. So what how does it impact? As I mentioned to you earlier, if you have high prices on every good that's not manufactured in the US. And as you know, because of global supply chains and how the global economy has been moving over the past, very close to even 100 years now, or close to at least 70 years, it's basically very, very interconnected. A part, like for example, is a small part of a part might be made in one country, it gets shipped to another country where it's assembled into one part, then it goes into the whole. And all of these things are basically done to be able to save money. The positive side of not having any tariffs is that goods are cheaper, right? You can make something in a cheaper country, ship it over to the United States, and then you can buy it for a lot cheaper than you could if it was made in the US, because just labor is more expensive, land is more expensive, all of those different types of things. So when you when the tariffs were announced last week, and this is, again, this is something that, looking at it from a perspective of just historically what they've done and what's possibly could happen in the future, apparel, things you wear, might increase by about 17%. Not everything that you buy in the grocery store that's organic, for example, vegetables and those things, are actually produced or grown in the US. And so because of that reason, prices of even your regular avocados, for example, that are grown in Mexico might go up in price because there's that tariff that's being implemented. And then the last one that I wanted to mention, and this is affecting a lot basically from the Canada and Mexico perspective, is a 25% tariff on automobiles, right? And so if you have a lot of your parts that are made, are some of them in the US, some of them in Canada, Mexico, and then shipped over, cost average might go up about $3,000 per car. But if it's majority made in another country like Canada or Mexico, it might even go further than that. It might be up to $6,000 per car that's actually happening. So it really depends. Right now, it's a little bit of an unknown as to what exactly is going to happen, because we really don't know exactly what the Trump administration is going to do. When we look at in the past, when we look at historically what's happened with tariffs, how different governments and or central banks have reacted, there is some kind of a past that we can look at, and I'll get into that in the next slide. But really what happens is that monetary policy is used. The central bank, in this particular case the Federal Reserve, could adjust interest rates to mitigate some of the harm that could be caused by tariffs. What do I mean by that? The first thing they can do is, in order to stimulate, obviously if costs of goods are going up, right, that means inflation is going to be higher, people can't afford things. And so what the Fed might do is that they might reduce interest rates to be able to stimulate the economy, right? And this was a Minneapolis Fed paper that came out right around the time that in 2018 when the Fed had implemented when the government had implemented tariffs. And they basically said that yes, you can use monetary policy to be able to influence behavior. And so as interest rates become cheaper, which right now they are higher, as you get cheaper, maybe there's more investments, maybe there's more people who can, the houses might become more affordable because interest rates are lower. So all of these things they can do to be able to stimulate the economy. The second thing is the rate hikes, which is on the flip side of that, right? And the dual mandate of the Federal Reserve is not only to stabilize prices but also to reduce unemployment. Right, so the stabilized prices part has to do with if tariffs are being implemented and they're going to be raising costs for the average consumer, then how do they control that? Right, now there's two things here. Number one is you have maybe a one-time a cost rise, right? That could happen if when tariffs happen. So if tariffs go up by 10%, all prices go up by 10%, and then you're done because there's no other price hikes that are going to take place. But or it could be sustained over a period of time because there's a trade war happens or something else that begins to happen, and so we really don't know, right? So the Fed doesn't know exactly what it's going to be. So it can basically raise interest rates to be able to control prices from getting out of hand, going up. And in 2018, when the steel tariffs did come in effect, that is what the Fed did. It did actually raise interest rates, and that's why you got a market reaction in 2018. Although it's been a long time, people might have forgotten the markets were down in 2018 because of that, right? However, that being said, and this is something that the Minneapolis Federal Reserve paper actually argued, was that the rate changes that you do, whether it be in cuts so that you stimulate the economy or hikes to be able to control inflation, they don't fully offset the effects that you're going to have or you're going to feel on the tariff side of it. And so that's kind of the negative side. But on the other side of that, long-term considerations, right? What happens is that if rates go up, things become more expensive, people stop spending money, GDP is going to go down, right? The tariffs begin to reduce GDP, and then the monetary policy alone isn't enough to be able to change any of that. So a lot of people ask sometimes, as the markets have been down now, hey, is this a COVID moment? Is it a 2008 moment where you had the Great Financial Crisis, something along those lines, right? So I wanted to start off and really mention two things. Number one is in 2008 when we had the when you had the financial crisis, that was a systemic breakdown in the financial system that we had, right? And so this is not one of those cases. I mean, tariffs are some things that are used by other countries. And so it's not you can't akin to that because we're not having the collapse of the entire financial world as we know it. So I don't think it's akin to that. However, somebody might argue that in during when COVID happened, there was an immediate stop to pretty much all types of commerce that were there from a global supply chain network, right? Because everything shut down, maybe things weren't being made, things weren't being shipped, things weren't being processed in the ports, those type of things. So that was a complete shutdown. I wouldn't say we're there, however, right? I used the analogy during COVID. If I spoke to some of you on the phone or in another seminar webinar that I'd done, I basically said, we're driving down the road at a 50 miles an hour, and what COVID did basically was put a barrier right in front of you, and bam, basically you hit the brakes and you hit the wall, and everything came to a standstill. Great. That is not what's happening here. What's happening here is basically, I'd like to give it an analogy of a drawbridge, right? You're going over a drawbridge at 50 miles an hour. Right. And somebody decides they're going to raise the drawbridge because of whatever reason. Right. And as you raise the drawbridge, obviously it's going to slow the car down because you have a different angle that you're going to be taking. And so what these tariffs are doing is they're basically acting as a drawbridge on the vehicle, which is the global economy. Right. It's becoming a lot more tougher to be able to predict that. So that's really what we're looking at. If you wanted to make an analogy, I would give you that analogy to be able to kind of think about and be able to use. Other than that, right, in 2002, George Bush actually did implement a tariff. It was a steel tariffs that he implemented, and but I think it was close to about a year later they rescinded it. But within that short period of time, there was a significant market drop. that you had. And so that was something that to kind of look at and say, like, hey, so in the past when tariffs have gone up, what has really happened to the market? Same thing in 2018, right? There was market volatility when Trump did announce his tariffs. Fed was already raising rates at the time. There was production increases modestly in the US because the tariffs were announced and they couldn't do anything, from the shipping them from abroad would have been more expensive. However, prices did rise because again, not everything that's manufactured here is going to be something that's going to be something that's good. So and then obviously the one that's we're having right now, which is the Trump tariffs of 2025, right? Markets have dropped. The long-term GDP unknown, right? Exactly what's going to happen. And part of this unknown is, interestingly enough, one of the largest donors for Trump is one of the he was the one who started Home Depot. And he basically said, look, if you're going to raise rates, there's a one-time adjustment that can happen, and we should be good with that. But what's really causing market panicking is the unknown. Right? Is the tariffs going to be 10%? Is it going to be lower? Is it going to be higher? Is there going to be bilateral negotiations? Are all of these things going to happen? And nobody really knows exactly what's going to be there. And so, right, all these investment banks and stuff that are coming out with these forecasts are basing it on these unknowns, right? And that's what's causing the volatility in the market. And why is there recession fear? It's because it's going to slow up. It's going to, if our prices go up, people are going to stop spending money, and that's going to affect GDP. And it could slow things down. That's why the recession is something that's talked about more and more, right? Why? But one thing to keep in mind is you don't want to wait for a recession to be able to see if the market goes down. The market is a predictor by about 6 to 9 months of what's going to happen in the future, and because we don't know what's going to happen in the future, the markets are basically reacting to what's happening, right? We talked a little bit about sector specific, right? If you think about it from your own expenditures perspective, right? We talked a little bit about the automobiles, but let's talk about it from retail, for example. So any industry that's reliant on imports, right? Things that are made abroad and are shipped to the US, right? Are going to be something that's going to be more affected. So companies like Nike, for example. Lululemon, which are both in the retail space, the garments are made elsewhere, right? If you ever look in whatever you're wearing, if you look at made in Vietnam or made in China, made in Bangladesh, sometimes even, and so all of these things, because they're being imported into the U.S., prices are going to rise. It's going to be more expensive for you to be able to buy, and that's going to be able to cause a little bit of turmoil. Now, there's two things that companies can do, right? Number one, what they can do is they can actually raise prices themselves. So 10% increase of tariffs, I'm going to raise my prices by 10%, right? Other companies, because they have a healthier balance sheet, they might be able to absorb some of those tariffs, right? And not pass those prices on to the consumer, right? Now, if you're looking at it from a perspective of Nike, or you can look at any two companies, and I'm just making this up right now, but let's supposing you have company A, company B, right? Company B says, look, I can't afford to, I have debt on my balance sheet. I can't afford to, cut my costs or raise my costs to be able to pass on the consumer. So they're going to pass everything on versus company B, that's going to be like, we have a healthy balance sheet. We don't have any debt. We have good margins. We're going to absorb some of this, and we're going to only pass on to the consumer 5% of an upper of an increase, right? So which company is going to survive? Obviously, you're going to gravitate more towards a company that only raised prices by 5% rather than 10%. And this gets into a little bit later. We're going to be talking about the idea of where do you want to see the investments taking place are going to be in these areas where companies are have good balance sheets, they have low debt, and they're able to maybe not all of it, but absorb some of the costs to the tariffs and pass some of them out. But obviously, by absorbing some of the costs themselves, that company A is going to be lowering their margins, and then from there lowering their profits. And that's why, again, the markets are adjusting to those type of things as well, right? So, right, again, going back to the inflation, right, it causes people to spend less because prices are higher, right? And especially when you're looking at lower cost items, vegetables, those type of things, those are going to get affected very, very heavily in this environment. So as I mentioned earlier, businesses sometimes are able to adjust, right? You have the diversification of supply chain, right? If you look at the surveys that have been done that basically said when the first China tariffs were implemented a few years back, what companies began to do, they said, okay, that's fine. It might be cheaper for us to be able to go to Vietnam and manufacture things there and then ship them for there, because Vietnam at that point had lower tariffs or no tariffs, and China had was getting, being implemented with tariffs, right? So businesses can adjust to whatever the situation is by being able to adjust their supply chain or diversify it a little bit more, right? They can even adjust to hiring and investments. They can increase it one location or decrease another location. The problem becomes is that if there's uncertainty, businesses don't know what to do, right? So for example, if you're a manufacturer, and you're looking at basically saying now, now if there's a 25% tariff on Mexico, right? Do I want to move my factories from Mexico to the US to be able to compensate for that, right? Those are long-term billions of dollars worth of investments that people have to make decisions on. And if they don't know whether or not today it's 25% and tomorrow they're going to be negotiated and it might go down even further, you can't make any decisions. You'll just say, let's wait and see. We'll see exactly what happens. We'll let things play out, and then we'll make our decision. That's going to affect hiring, because you might reduce your hiring. Obviously, that's going to affect investments, all of those different types of things that are going on, right? The worst case scenario, right? And that is something that again, nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen, because we're right in the middle of it, right? If there's a global retaliation, China's already come out and said, hey, US, you raised our tariffs by 34%. We're going to raise our tariffs on you by 30%. And now Trump has come out and said, well, if you keep that, I'm going to raise it by 50% tomorrow. That's called a trade war, right? And that's not good for anybody. That's going to cause a lot of pain, and it's going to be a lot of damage that's done. Luckily, what's happened is that 50 countries have already been knocking on the door of the Trump administration saying, hey, can we negotiate a better rate than the one that you're wanting to implement upon us, right? And that's something that you can negotiate out, and you can say, well, okay, you were slated for 50%, now you're going to be down to 50, 10% or 15%. That makes it a little bit more digestible than anything that's happened. And if you get if you get a trade war, right? That is something that is going to be cause a global slowdown. That's going to be, it's already people are talking about that as of right now as well, right? Now, all that being said, and now I'm going to probably turn it over to Dan to talk about this, right? All I've really said is a lot of the negative, because there is a lot of uncertainty that's out there. And generally speaking, in the world order that we have today, what it's all about, global supply chains, goods moving back and forth, either through shipping or other things, there has been that disruption, right? And there has been, as I mentioned, the drawbridge has begun to rise. And so it's a natural consequence for the global economy to be able to slow down. How much it slowed down, how companies or countries react to it, those are all the unknowns that are out there. And so that's what's going to cause the between now and, let's supposing, the next few months, what's going to cause the markets to either go up a lot or go down a lot. But this volatility is not something that we need to react to right now, because not all is going to be negative. There are going to be positives that are going to come out of it, and it's really, really important for us to be able to stay invested and really think about what it is you want to adjust. Because there might be some adjustments you want to make. But generally speaking, if you're 20 years old, 25, 30, you're just beginning to invest now, you have 20, 30 years in the future, right? I would still say that don't count the global economy out. There are still opportunities that are going to be out there. New opportunities are going to be created. New companies that are going to be benefiting. New countries that might actually benefit from these things as well. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan. Dan, I'll move your slides for you. Just let me know when you want to do that.
That's great. Thank you, Muneem. So obviously tons of moving parts. I can totally sympathize with everyone that's going through this. In moments like these, I found it helpful to just take a step back and try to organize your thoughts into a few core observations and really try to distill what are the key questions we're trying to figure out as investors. From a market standpoint, I think we're either at or pretty close to maximum uncertainty. I mean, we really have a situation where there's just an open-ended range of outcomes. And when this happens, you're just going to have stocks that almost completely detach from their investment fundamentals, which I know can be alarming. So, my advice would be, just be aware that this happens, and it's not necessarily, a reason to be panicking right now. And Munim kind of touched on this before, but another key question that we need to figure out is what's happening with global growth? Obviously, we're entering into a period of stagnation, but is that stagnation also going to be combined with sustained inflation? So that's kind of the worst of both worlds. And so, I think you shouldn't look at inflation just in terms of all or nothing. I do believe that there's going to be a short-term component with, of course, a ratchet higher initially, but then that's probably going to lead to a slower overall growth from a global perspective on a sustained basis. And again, if we have a continued escalation that just continues for years and years, obviously that is very negative. But for the time being, it does look, at least from a bond market's reaction perspective, that we're going to see some pretty negative impact to economic growth. But that's also going to, somewhat offset itself with slower, sustained growth, which means lower interest rates. The third issue here is, in terms of the tariffs themselves, it's also not a monolithic entity. The way that I try to package tariffs is there are two broad categories in my opinion. The first would be more transactional in nature, and the second is structural. And again, we kind of touched on this, but the transactional tariffs, generally speaking, I believe are these so-called reciprocal tariffs. And obviously, the administration has put on some pretty aggressive, anchor points to start the negotiations. But the overall purpose, or at least one of the core purposes of this, is to try to get better trade terms for the U.S., maybe in countries that just are going to structurally have a deficit. Maybe the administration aggressively convinces them to buy more aerospace, for instance. But I think the purpose of that is to benefit the U.S. economy. The second is really much more sustainable and negative. And these are, for example, things like 25% on steel, aluminum, and auto imports, where the U.S. really wants to reestablish and reindustrialize production capacity within the U.S. Over the next 10 years, perhaps, geopolitical tensions do arise and accelerate. And so in that type of environment, it does seem like the administration wants to have more of that geopolitical leverage. And the only way to do that really is to bring some of that production as well as minerals back to the U.S. And then lastly, there's this concept of this Trump put versus call. And I don't need to get too into the weeds there, but the first administration, the president was notoriously very interested in seeing how the stock markets did as an indicator of his job performance. And so, of course, everyone expected that same playbook to work this term. But then they also got excited about this call option, where not only is downside going to be protected, because if stock markets go down too much, then perhaps the president would jump in to save the day. But also, people started getting excited about these pro-growth policies, tax cuts, energy renaissance. And so, we kind of entered the year with positives on the protection as well as upside front. And then that kind of spectacularly ended when the markets realized that there was no Trump put, or if there was one, the strike price was much lower than people were hoping for. And then this call option, these growth policies, at some point will come into play, but we're kind of upfronted with a lot of the sort of medicine and the negatives in terms of tariffs and trade wars before that happens. So, we kind of had this reversal of these two positives that the market was expecting. So it does make rational sense why the markets have reacted in the ways that they have. Next slide. So kind of bringing it all together, I think Monim touched on this quite well, but as an investor, where you want to be positioning yourself is, over the next 10, 5 to 10 years, I think one of the most visible or predictable outcomes out of all this craziness is that, yes, we are going to see at least incrementally higher tariffs, and that's going to have a negative impact in terms of global growth. And so in that environment, the question is, who takes the brunt of these tariff hikes? Is it the supplier? Is it the importer? Or is it the consumer? And it's almost become a political question at this point, where I'm sure people in Trump's cabinet are going to say, of course, China is going to take 95% of all these tariff increases. They're just going to take it. And other people might say it's going to be the consumer. I don't think it's political at all, actually. And I think the way that you can position your portfolios are you want to have companies that have pricing power. Because ultimately, if you have pricing power, you're going to have more demand for your goods on a relative basis than supply. So, if there are tariffs, you're going to be much more, easily able to pass on those tariffs, or at least the majority, onto either the supplier or the importer, and the consumer. So as long as you're structuring your portfolio with companies, obviously with good balance sheets, but also that have this pricing power, I think that's going to be the single most relevant investment thematic that you're going to want to be on the right side of over the next few years. Yep, next slide. As an investor, what should you be doing? What's the actionable game plan in all this? Well, first of all, again, I don't think it's time to panic. But in life, and my parents used to tell me this, but there are things that you can control, and then there are others that you can't. And so it's the same outlay in the markets. Right now, there's nothing we can do to control what direction geopolitics takes place. We can't speculate. I have no idea where the tariffs are going over the next couple quarters even. But there are absolutely things that we do have control over. For instance, can we manage risk better? Can we diversify, rebalance? One thing I'm doing right now for my clients is tax loss harvesting. It's very painful what we're going through right now. But through this pain, the sort of side effects, there are positives where you can take advantage of some of these losses and crystallize and harvest those capital losses that can act as tax shields later on in the year. So we're taking this pain. You might as well take on the benefits during this process instead of just kind of sitting on your portfolios. These are aspects that we can absolutely control. So I would encourage everyone to call up their advisors and really just to give as much disclosure to us as possible. Tell us about your tax situation, what you're expecting in terms of capital gains. And so really it should be a collaborative effort to take advantage and to protect ourselves in these types of situations. That's all I had.
All right. Thank you to both Dan and to Monim for the presentation. And we do have a good number of questions as well. And Monim and Dan, you can answer it, whoever wants to answer this. A retired person is saying, I have all of my investment money in Amana Income and Growth Fund. Is there something that I should be doing differently? Should I have already sold it before? So if you can kind of address this question, looking at this person's question, but also, there's a lot of people like that, right? They're in the stage that they're retired. They may or may not be using money, but now they're feeling the anxiety of it. Dan mentioned, you don't want to take unnecessary, you don't want to make unnecessary changes right now. But what does it mean for somebody in this particular situation?
So I'll start, Dan. And you know, I think what Dan mentioned really important was what's called risk management, right? Which is really then that is something you can control. Which is really looking at the portfolio and saying, look, you know, when markets are going up, it's very easy to say that you can take on risk. When markets come down is when you really figure out exactly could you really take that risk or could you not? And that's why it's really important for all of us to look at our look at diversification strategies. We have you know, multiple funds in the amount of funds for a reason. We have growth, we have you know, large cap value, large cap growth, we have developing world, and we have a Sukuk fund as well. And so what you might need to think about is not from a, you know, all or none. Do I move from one fund to another or those type of things? What you might think about is maybe dialing down your risk tolerance, right? Because you've begun to realize that you can't take the risk, right? Now this is the time you can do that. So it's not a tomorrow thing, right? It might be a thing that you do over maybe next a couple of weeks or a couple of months, where you think about what the market's going to be doing. Are you able to stomach the risk or not? And then dial down. What I mean by that is, you know, if you look at the order of our funds, our most conservative is our Sukuk fund, the participation fund. Then you go to amount of income fund, then to growth fund, and then developing world. And so if you have overweight in one versus another, if you want to be more risky, you can go up the ladder. And if you want to go more conservative, you can go down the ladder from that risk perspective.
Yep, I think that's a great strategy. And the only thing I would add is, again, it kind of depends on your situation, right? Like if you, for some reason, you need this capital over the next 12 to 24 months, you should, you know, much more highly consider moving that to either cash or something that's cash equivalent. The Sukuk fund is a, you know, very nice way to generate some income, but that should not be invested in my opinion directly into you know, equities. So that would be my recommendation. If you do have the ability and have some tactical losses in terms of capital losses that you can realize, especially if you're expecting some sort of capital gain expectation this year, you could potentially use that to offset. And then potentially redeploy into a basket of securities. Maybe it's a, you know, managed account from one of your advisors. But those are some decisions that you can make. And again, I'm not recommending getting out of your core positions, but if some of these stocks have generally this a similar investment characteristic and correlation, you absolutely can take advantage of that capital loss. And still participate in the markets. So, you know, a range of options depending on your situation, but definitely things that you should at least be thinking about and considering with your advisor right now.
Yeah, I want to add just to that, Dan. You might make a really good point about tax loss harvesting. And I just want to add one point thing. So, tax loss harvesting doesn't mean you go from being invested to not being invested. It basically means you're going to be, you invested in one thing, you're taking a little loss and buying something very similar, so that if there is the market gain, you're going to be able to participate as well. So it's not you know, it's not a zero sum game. It's not zero or 100%. You're just reshifting your portfolio to be able to take advantage of the loss, but really distributing it back to something very, very similar. That's number one. Number two is we have a fund selector on our website that you can actually go to, and you can look at the allocation that's made based on a set of questions that you ask you ha answer. That we ask you and you answer based on, and it'll give you your risk tolerance. And based on that risk tolerance, it'll give you a optimum portfolio that you should be invested in. So I would highly recommend everybody taking a look at that.
So we are getting questions that are on both sides, right? Can I use this as an opportunity? Should I sell everything and, you know, put the money in bank accounts and so forth? So we'll get to some of those questions. One of the things that we mentioned was the Sukuk Fund. It's named the Participation Fund, the Amana Participation Fund. That's something that you can look into on our website, amanafunds.com. Or as I have put into the group there, my email address if you want to talk further about any of these different options. So some of the questions, I'll just get to them and you all can answer them. I have a monthly purchase program into the amount of funds. What should I do with that? And so I guess the question is implying, should I stop investing on a monthly basis or every 2 weeks as I've been doing for the last few years and hold on for a while, or should I continue that or do more of it?
Oh, that's an easy one for me. If you have the bandwidth to be able to do more, I think that's definitely the way the way to approach this. If I wouldn't definitely stop. The reason why we started in the first place is if you know it's called dollar cost averaging. And so that $100 that you're putting in a month, if the market goes down by 20%, guess what? You got a 20% sale on the stocks that you owned. And in the longer run, that's going to work out really, really well for you. Remember, you're going to see the portfolio, and it's going to look to you as you're just buying one fund, right? But in the background, myself, Dan, other portfolio manager and analysts, we are doing the research, the necessary research on the companies themselves and on the overall portfolio to make sure that we're going to be able to withstand, not 100%, but as much as possible, any shocks that are coming through. And that's really, really important to keep in mind. So the companies with the good balance sheets that we talked about, the companies that can withstand pricing pressures, those are the companies that we want to be in, and for the most part, we are in. If there are some adjustments we need to make, we'll make them. But from your perspective as an investor in the funds, right, be know that we're doing our homework, and I think if you are able to increase your dollar cost averaging.
Is there an opportunity now to buy the dip for a middle-aged long-term investor? So you can see there's, people questioning whether they should sell everything and then whether they should buy more.
Then you want to take it?
So again, it kind of de depends on your unique circumstances, but everything else held equal. And again, if you have the ability to deploy this capital over a sort of medium to long term, absolutely. I mean, I am myself. I mean, it feels painful right now. It doesn't feel comfortable. But generally that's not the worst time to be deploying capital. So if that's been your strategy, if you've held back potentially, but you have the ability to deploy that capital, I think just from a long-term perspective, that's what I would be recommending right now.
Okay, thank you. So there's a question here. I'm going to retire in 5 years. What should my portfolio be? It's in a 401k. So I'll just answer that because Monim already addressed it. You should look at our Amana fund selector on our website, and it'll give you insight into what your risk tolerance and your timeline is. So what that portfolio should look like. And I've shared my email address. So if you want us to help you with that, we can as well. There's a really good question here that we'll have to, think about a little bit. There were large capital gains in some of the funds last year, which are currently looming IRS dues, right? So can funds take capital losses, or are they restricted to do that end of October? You mentioned individual tax planning. How about for the funds themselves?
That's a really good question, very thought-provoking one. So very similar to an individual, funds actually can do tax loss harvesting as well. So we could sell things now, and then in hopes that if something goes up, we sell later, we can offset the capital losses with the gains. So that is also the case. The funds, alhamdulillah, have done so well that we don't have very many losses in the funds themselves. And so the only thing you could hope for is that if we sell it, it would be maybe X percentage less capital gains than you would have paid if the market was higher. But we do have mitigation strategies to be able to what we're trying to implement within our funds. If you have a take a look at our prospectus and you find not to get into here, but take a look at the prospectus, and we do have a program called Reflow that we use to be able to mitigate some of our capital gains as well. And so we are taking as many measures as we can to do that.
There's a question. I mean, this is a pretty specific question about tariffs themselves. Maybe you can answer it, or you can opine, right? It's not a guarantee that we can get this answer correct. When will we start to see prices increase?
Okay, since Jen is not saying anything else, I'll jump in. It's really hard to predict. So one of the things that would we do is we know certain things that have happened, right? If you look at companies, they have had inventory buildup in anticipation of the tariffs, right? So I'll give you a really good example of that. And this is more anecdotal, not something that the company actually came out and said. But Nintendo right, on Independence Day last week, actually announced the new Switch, right? But prior to their announcement of the new Switch, if you look at traffic flow from Japan into the U.S. from a certain area, you'll notice that there was a pickup in about 500,000 units were shipped between Japan and the U.S. So people are speculating that was Nintendo actually pre-ordering or pre-shipping the Switches prior to the prices going up. So a lot of that has been done, right? And so some maybe it might take a couple of months before that inventory draws down to be able to, for that to happen. Or the other way to look at it is the company might say, I have this, I bought it cheaper. They've already announced the tax, the tariffs. Let me just raise my prices now for 10%. I'll just capture that in my margins. So there's many different ways that companies can react to know exactly when that's going to happen. It'll be in phases, but I don't think any us as investment professionals can say that. Maybe as managers and you know C-suites of the companies, they can. Dan, you want to add anything?
Yeah, that was a good answer. The only thing I would add is, you know, it also depends on what product you're talking about, and it kind of comes back down to pricing power again, right? So if you have a product that is very easily replaceable with a different product from perhaps a different country, maybe it's a beverage or apparel or any type of item that perhaps you can just as easily get from a different country or region, you probably won't see, you know, a one-for-one price increase to the consumer. If you have something that is, you know, extremely strong in terms of pricing power, maybe it's a GPU or a semiconductor chip that's the latest sort of cutting edge model, then you're probably going to see that impact right away. So it really kind of depends on the dynamics of pricing power. As well as obviously the tax and tariff regime that it's coming from.
I want to give one example. If you ever think about oil prices and gas prices, right? When oil prices go up and down based on what OPEC is doing, for example, you'll notice that when prices go up on oil, your gas price at the station goes up automatically. But when prices come down, it's slowly going to come down, right? And I think you can say something very similar. On the tariff side as well, is that there are going to be items like as Dan mentioned, they're going to be automatically raised now, and others that are going to slowly take their time to do that, depending on what the inventory levels and the replaceability of that product was.
And time will tell, and you know each company is going to be different, because if you look at the news, Apple is talking about moving more of their production into their Indian plant and exporting more from there. Because of the lower tariff from there. So, you know, companies will try to figure it out because they still want to sell those units. They need to sell those units. They don't want to have a crash of their stock even further to what it has been now. And then also states are also looking at the same thing. So California, where I live, the governor is working out deals with individual countries and saying, hey, don't tariff us because, you know, you're going to rely on these particular products. And it's just going to create more of a ripple effect throughout the world. So let's work together since we're the fifth largest economy in the world. And I know Illinois is doing something similar. So we don't know where all of that's going to go. There's a question here that I think we do need to answer, which is someone saying, you know, they are maybe panicking a little bit and saying, should I pull my money and put it into a certificate of deposit and bring it back later, right? And so the market's down, what, 13% or so, something like that, in the last few days. So when it stabilizes, quote unquote, right, this is the timing the market scenario. And then the question that goes along with it, this is not in a IRA account because you wouldn't put it into a CD necessarily. It's outside of that. What is the tax implication? So how do we answer that one? Because it's a real question that many people are considering. And so how do we answer that for folks?
I think from my perspective, look, it's all a matter of time horizon, right? I mean, if you're thinking that this money was you're going to be using for Hajj this year, right? Number one, it shouldn't have been in the stock market in the first place. But since already it's in there now, right? Yes, you would want to be able to take it out and use it for the Hajj purpose that you had made, which is in a couple of months. But if you're a long term, and what I mean by long term is, you do have 20, 30 years until you retire, then, look at this as a buying opportunity, right? And, what happens next week, what happens next month, we don't know, right? And I don't want to be Pollyanna about it. I mean, there are some tough times ahead, but I want you to think about it from the 2008 perspective. 2008 was not a one-time a one-time event. It actually took about a year and a half before the market stabilized. There was a lot of, banks going under, markets going up and down, all of these. There was a turmoil for about a year and a half, but we got through it. And the biggest mistake you would have made in 2008 was if you sold from your portfolio, because most likely you wouldn't have been able to get back in. So in the same thing over here, I don't want to tell you that everything's going to be okay tomorrow. I don't know, right? But what I would tell you is that we are going to go through some pain, but the pain has some opportunity. And the second thing is that don't ever count the global economy out. And what I mean by that is eventually companies, countries are going to figure out ways to be able to make money. And they'll be able to make money maybe even better than they were before. And all of that really means is that we need to be invested over the longer term rather than trying to time what would be the right time to get in or not.
And is there a potential that this could all be reversed? And what would that mean for the market?
Yeah, that's called a V-shaped recovery. But I think again that's part of the reason why the markets are doing what they're doing. The uncertainty is what he can't figure out, right? As I mentioned to you in my example of companies that are looking to spend billions of dollars on plants, where are they going to build it? That uncertainty is what's causing this, the driving force behind the markets being down. And that's something that if he came out tomorrow and said, "Sorry guys, I was just kidding. I'm not going to do any of the tariffs at all." Then we're pretty much back to where we were maybe 4 or 5 months ago, when there's nothing in place. I don't think that's going to happen, but there are going to be probably settled negotiations between bilateral negotiation between countries. And I was mentioning it to Dan in another meeting we had, and said I'd hate to be that trade representative that has to deal with 50 countries of phone calls at the same time to be able to come there. Everybody's banging on the U.S. doors and saying we want to negotiate. And so it will happen. It'll just take some time, and use this time as an opportunity to buy more.
I would just add, it's tough to predict, even if we're going to go into a recession because of all this or not. But I do want to at least end my thoughts by just telling you, if you participate in companies that have this pricing power, they're secular growers, and they have this compounding capability, it doesn't really matter if you go into a recession or not, because during recessions, these same companies are going to be aggressively either disrupting or pushing out their competition or consolidating them. If we don't go into a recession and we go back into expansionary mode, these are the same companies that are going to be aggressively reinvesting into their respective moats, and which is just going to put them in a stronger and stronger competitive positioning over the full market cycle. So you're going to end up with a compounder that outperforms the market and its sector in a downturn as well as the upturn. So as long as you can hold on to these types of names over the medium to long terms, I mean that's really how you should be looking at your portfolio and taking some peace of mind, especially during these moments of super elevated volatility that can induce emotions out of everyone. So
Dan, I know this is a leading question, but would you say that's what we're doing in our funds?
I mean that kind of hits home to exactly how we're positioning ourselves. We're not trying to predict next quarter, and I kind of compare this to an analogy where you don't want to be picking up dollar bills in front of a steamroller, right? Because you're probably going to be just fine. That steamroller is going at a very slow speed, and you can continue to pick up these dollar bills, and maybe that's your strategy. But what if something crazy happens? What if your foot gets caught in something, or you have a panic attack? I mean, these very low probability events that can have a significant sort of sustained negative impact on your portfolio, we just don't want to even speculate and you know position ourselves to have any exposure to those types of names, which is why you know we don't have to swing for the fences up the risk ladder and still be able to generate above market returns over the full market cycle. So why bother? And I think it's especially helpful, and it becomes more visible during moments like this.
You know, we're at our time here, so we'll end with one more question. But the final question, the Mag 7, so that's, you know, Amazon, Google, you know, Facebook, quite Meta, et cetera, those kinds of companies, the Mag 7 took a significant hit, which in theory they could absorb any cost of tariffs because they're so large and, you know, they're well capitalized, et cetera. There was also an exemption on semiconductors from tariffs. Generally, halal funds have been technology concentrated. Why do you think this is the case? And how do you think about the headwinds and tailwinds for the tech industry?
Yeah, I could take that one. You know, I think I hate generalizing with the Mag 7. I think there are definite differences and different investment themes embedded within those seven names. I personally do find the semiconductor infrastructure construct to be in a sort of a, you know, 5 to 10 year structural upturn. Obviously, there's pockets within there that are stronger than others. But I mean that's pretty much well reflected in why the Trump administration specifically singled out you know areas like semiconductors. I mean that's a massive trade deficit in the perspective of the US. And so it just I mean you know actions speak louder than words. This is exactly what I'm talking about. And so you know whether it's semiconductors or you know AI infrastructure that's being deployed over the cloud, these are likely going to be areas, and of course they're going to get impacted too if we go into a global recession. Absolutely, they're going to get hit, but on a relative basis, do they have more of that secular structural growth to withstand a recessionary or contractionary environment? And the answer is, you know, yes, I believe so. But again, as I pointed out earlier, it doesn't really matter. During these moments of you know, elevated extreme volatility, these fundamentals tend to almost completely detach from the actual fundamentals that are taking place and their stock prices. And so, you know, this is why it's important to have a level head, but also be confident that the investments that have been deployed are in companies that will be able to weather perhaps moderate to severe recession in one piece. Obviously not unscathed, but you know that gives you that visibility that you need. So you don't need to be constantly worrying, oh no, if I mispredicted this the turnout of this trade tariff war and we actually go into a moderate recession, then I need to start recalibrating everything. And so that's where you can get into a lot of trouble as an investor. That's where you probably should be making adjustments because your portfolio is probably vulnerable. So you know we'll let the hyper sort of short to medium term strategies duke it out over that type of landscape in terms of an investment you know layout and approach. But for us, I mean we do have that longer term visibility and confidence. To not be able or not have to worry about the shorter term implications. So in short, yes, I think tech, generally speaking, has that secular growth. You know, I think growth is going to become more scarce as tariffs go higher and global GDP becomes stagnated. And especially if demand declines over time and inflation goes down, that also plays decently well into the narrative as well.
Anything to add, Monim, on that particular?
No, good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we thank you both, Monim and Dan. And what we will likely do is have another one of these sessions in the future, just depending on how this all plays out. Thank you again. We'll catch you next time. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Halal Money Matters. If you like what you hear, please do rate us on the app stores and also leave us a review. It helps other people find us a lot easier.
The thoughts and opinions expressed on Halal Money Matters do not necessarily reflect the views of Saturna Capital, Amana Mutual Funds, or their affiliates. Please consider an investment's objectives, risks, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. To obtain this and other important information about the Amana Funds in a current prospectus or summary prospectus, please visit amanafunds.com or call toll-free 1-800-728-8762. Please read the prospectus or summary prospectus carefully before investing. The Amana Funds are distributed by Saturna Brokerage Services, member FINRA and SIPC, and a wholly owned subsidiary of Saturna Capital, the investment advisor to the Amana Funds. Investing involves risk, including the risk that you could lose money. The Amana Funds restrict investments to those companies consistent with Islamic and sustainable principles, which limits opportunities and may affect performance. This material is for general information only and is not a research report or commentary on any investment products offered by Saturna Capital. This material should not be construed as an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to buy any security in any jurisdiction where such an offer or solicitation would be illegal. We do not provide tax, accounting, or legal advice to our clients, and all investors are advised to consult with their tax, accounting, or legal advisors regarding any potential investment. Investors should not assume that investments in the securities and/or sectors described were or will be profitable. This podcast is prepared based on information Saturna Capital deems reliable. However, Saturna Capital does not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the information. Investors should consult with a financial advisor prior to making an investment decision. The views and information discussed in this commentary are at a specific point in time, are subject to change, and may not reflect the views of the firm as a whole. All material presented in this publication, unless specifically indicated otherwise, is under copyright to Saturna. No part of this publication may be altered in any way, copied or distributed without the prior express written permission of Saturna Capital.
Performance data quoted herein represents past performance and is no guarantee of future results. Investment return and principal value of an investment will fluctuate so that an investor's shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than their original cost. Current performance may be significantly higher or lower than data quoted herein. Performance current to the most recent month end can be obtained by visiting amanafunds.com or by calling toll-free 1-800-728-8762. Please consider an investment's objectives, risks, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. To obtain this and other important information, which you should carefully consider before investing, about the Amana Funds in a free prospectus or summary prospectus, please visit amanafunds.com or call 1-800-728-8762.